Hey, welcome to Old School Guns. This is episode number 37, and we're the podcast that tells you like it is. We're beholden to no one. We have no sponsors, no network. We're completely independent, and we have completely independent opinions to give you. So anyway, we'll go ahead and, by the way, if you happen to like what you hear, go ahead and hit the like or the follower button. And if you don't like what you hear, you can tell your friends and you can leave comments on Podbean or any place else where you happen to be hearing this. And we'll be happy to address those. So even if you hate us, go ahead and spread the word. Going to get into a couple quick things. First of all, got some updated information. Last podcast talked about the Taurus Judge. Mistakenly said it was in a 7.5 inch barrel. It is actually 6.5. That was a mistake on my notes. Actually, in looking at it, if I'd been paying better attention, I really don't like 7.5 revolvers, 8 inch revolvers. To me, they're just outside the envelope of real use. Now, that of course doesn't mean that I don't have one or two, but I really like 6.5 and shorter for revolver barrels. It's just really nice. But anyway, that's what the Taurus Judge comes in. It's actually 6.5, which means that it's long for a holster gun, but it's still eminently usable. And, you know, all the things I said about it are still withstanding. So anyway, that's one correction. Another is an update. We're talking about the Beretta Model 81 Cheetah, which has kind of hit the surplus market. Some police trade-ins have hit the market. I think those are priced from about $210 to about $250. You know, for a Beretta, that's a very nice price. Even though it is 32 caliber, it's a 12-shot gun. Nice gun, nice overall package. And however, I noticed Classic Firearms did not have spare magazines for sale, but Robertson Trading Company does. And this info comes to us from our friend on the podcast, and he basically is kind of checking these things out, and he said, yes, they are available. So I went there, and of course, they are available. It's a Mekkar magazine. If you know Mekkar, they produce a lot of OEM magazines for a lot of European guns. So they're a quality manufacturer, and they're not cheap. They're $28. I mean, you know, that's not horribly expensive, but it's not cheap either. So anyway, I can't imagine needing more than one or two at the most of spare magazines, because the gun comes with one. So if you've got two or three magazines, you're set. And just to go over, you know, as I said before, you know, coming out of a little bit longer barrel, the 32 doesn't give up much in practical terms to the 380. So it's a nice little gun. 32 ammunition, you know, if you buy it from some of the online guys, look around for a deal, you can get reasonable. It's never going to be as cheap as 9mm Parabellum, but it's, you know, you can get some $15-16 a box stuff, which is going to be fine, good stuff to use. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit of politics, and you know, you've heard about this Ukraine deal, and you know, Trump evidently was pressuring them to investigate Hunter Biden. Hunter Biden, by the way, evidently he had some dealy going on, and nobody's really kind of explained what all this is, but he had some deal going on in the Ukraine, and apparently they were suspicious he was bilking them of money. Yeah, imagine that. And so anyway, they were going to investigate him and all this other stuff. And they've accused Trump of trying to pressure the Ukraine president to investigate him. But there's a couple things that they're conveniently leaving out. And one is Hunter Biden is a punk. Hunter Biden is a little rat fink who was kicked out of the Navy Reserve in less than a year because of his drug abuse. He's a drug abuser. And the only reason he got some gig in the Ukraine and somehow got access to money and everything else is due to his daddy's influence peddling. This is privilege to the max. His daddy's influence peddling, the same influence peddling which got him into the Navy when he was over age and when he had to get another waiver. He had to get two waivers, one for being over age, which, you know, is understandable, you know, especially when somebody is a civilian lawyer, as Hunter Biden is. You know, they bring those kind of people in, the acquired civilian skills. There's opportunity for that. But he was over age for that, so he gets a waiver. I can understand that. But he got a second waiver due to his prior record of arrests for drug abuse. And this is not a single arrest. This isn't he smoked a doobie in college and got caught. No, this is a pattern of drug abuse. So this drug abuser, and face it, we all know people who abuse drugs. They're usually not the kind of people who, on their own, without any help, without anybody exerting influence or opening doors for them, they're not going to go get some multi-million-dollar gig in the Ukraine. You know, his connection to then-Vice President Biden is what opened the door. And you know the old man was opening up the doors for this punk because he wants this kid to somehow make good, to somehow retrieve, you know, what he is and try to, you know, become something better than just the drug abusing, spoiled little entitled punk that this little rat fink is. So that's what they're not telling you about the Ukraine. So it's all about the swamp. And the reason they're after Trump, they could care less that he told the Ukraine president to try to investigate him or whatever else. This is the essence of a swamp creature from Washington, Hunter Biden and Daddy Joe Biden. They are creatures of the swamp, and now the swamp is boiling and reacting because you know all these power brokers in the House of Representatives, they've all got dirty connections that are just as bad and maybe even in some cases worse than little Hunter Biden has. So these punks, these disgusting punks, are now trying to gin up some sort of impeachment deal. And I mean, they're rats. They're complete rats. I mean, if we don't need it, we need a complete house cleaning, especially the House of Representatives. That thing has become a morass. Unfortunately, in 2018, somehow, the swamp got back in charge, and the swamp is a dirty, smelly, disgusting cesspool of real toilet bugs. And that's what these politicians are. They're toilet bugs. I mean, believe me, they retire as millionaires, never having had a job and just being in public service. You know, you don't become a millionaire for a $175,000 a year job. You don't become a person with $40 or $50 or $70 million when you've had a career for maybe 10 or 15 years in the House of Representatives. It's impossible unless you've been tipped off, you've been paid off, you've been taken care of with some of these sweetheart deals, and that all comes back to one place, your pocket, your taxes. And I'm sure that a lot of the money that Hunter Biden was swindling had to have been USAID, military assistance money, all kinds. There's all these, what they call in the game, all these colors of money, different types of money that are given for, you know, earmarked or fenced for different types of uses. So all these colors of money are pouring into the Ukraine because, after all, Russia was hassling the Ukraine. And that's yet another story. You know, all this money was pouring into the Ukraine, and so you're going to have opportunists over there fleecing the Ukrainians who are desperate. The last thing, if you're a Ukrainian, the last thing you want is to be under Russian control. It's a very bad place to be. So they don't want to do that. Now, as a legacy of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, there are large ethnic Russian populations in a lot of the former satellite countries or a lot of the former SSRs that Sovietsky, you know, Soyuz republics that were out there. And, you talk about something like Crimea. Well, after Stalin died in 1953, there was a lot of kind of chaos, turmoil, indecision in the Soviet government. And that's when the Crimea was transferred from the Russian SSR to the Ukrainian SSR. Hey, if you took a piece of New Jersey and gave it to New York, or vice versa, you know, it at that time it didn't make that big a difference. It wasn't that big of a deal. But when the Soviet Union broke up and Ukraine kept it, as you know, they thought they were entitled to, that was reasonable to expect. The Russians objected. They objected in 1994 and they finally went and took it back in 2013. You know, I mean, it was inevitable that was going to happen. Even Nikita Khrushchev, who kind of took over after Stalin, but there had been a period where he wasn't in charge. He looked at the document that transferred it and said these guys had to have been all drunk. So, you know, it's one of these things of history kind of going one way, and now we're in this phase where the Russians are trying to correct what they perceive as some of the negative aspects and some of the bad breaks of history. And one of those bad breaks is, okay, the Ukraine, we think of the Ukraine, okay, it's populated by Ukrainians, there's a border, there are Ukrainians on one side, and there are Russians on the other. And we think that they're very, very different people, when in fact they're very similar, they're more like cousins. Ukrainians and Russians, the language is very, very similar, they can understand each other, they're a lot closer than what we imagine. But there's also, because of the Soviet Union, large numbers of Russians were living out in what they called these satellite republics. And now Russia would like to have some of these ethnic populations and the land they're on back under their control. And it's not going to be a pretty process. It's not going to be pretty. So, you know, it is what it is. You know, you get over there and get involved in something like that, and there's no way that a Hunter Biden, a little drug-abusing worm, there's no way that he navigates that murky, very, very sensitive, very, very historically driven political world, that Byzantine world of, you know, these republics that were behind the Iron Curtain or part of the former Soviet Union, and their relationships with modern-day Russia. There's no way Hunter Biden is an expert in that. He's a little jerk, he's an opportunist, and he got caught. And because he's a Biden, he didn't get punished, but that's what it is. So think about that when they start talking about essentially this Ukraine and what a scandal this is. Another scandal, another piece of, it made me sad to see it. Normally I would be outraged, but the kid at the UN, this Greta Thunberg, she's from Sweden or Norway or someplace, and the little girl, she's a teenager, she's got Asperger's syndrome, you know, which is kind of a little bit of sort of an autistic style condition. I'm not an expert on it, but I know that, you know, you're not exactly, it's a challenge. It's a challenge when you got that. I don't know how debilitating it is, but it's a challenge. And they have this child up in front of the UN just scolding the world leaders, saying a lot of things that aren't true. Ecosystems are completely dying, and it's all our fault, and blah, 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 blah. You know, it was sad to watch a child who's been brainwashed by her parents, psychologically abused by her parents and probably others, into believing this garbage, and getting up and being able to present herself like that. The use of another human being to do that is, to me, extremely insidious. Extremely insidious. Regardless of what she's saying, this is the kind of horrible indoctrination you saw with Hitlerjugend, you know, all these kind of organizations. It's absolutely hideous and insidious. And the fact that Her parents probably are the ones that did it. They've indoctrinated this child. They've brainwashed, to use an old term. They've brainwashed, programmed this child so that she gets up and rather than worrying about her friends and school dances and the things that a teenager should be enjoying and what should be their life, they've got this child just worked up with this rage, this outrage about something that really none of us can control. And the global warming debate is something for another time. But, you know, and I see that. It makes the Manchurian candidate look like Charlie Brown Christmas, man. I mean, it when you see that and realize what it is, this isn't an adult who's had 10 years to form these opinions. This is a child who's been strongly indoctrinated. When you see that for what it is disturbing. And I hope, I don't know, everybody else just seems to think that this young girl is just the greatest thing, but it's insidious and it's evil. Okay, now we're starting to see something that, there's something that I hate, and that is pro-gun Democrats. The pro-gun Democrats are a bunch of liars, they're a bunch of frauds, and they're not even marginally believable. You know, pro-gun Democrats, remember they had John Kerry walking through a field with a shotgun like he does that. This is a guy who's one of the most effete. This is the guy who went to Wendy's, stopped his campaign bus. They all bought food at Wendy's, you know, so the press could see that they're just regular people like everybody else getting their fast food. Well, they took that stuff and then they were seen dumping it, and then they were eating stuff like prosciutto and brie and all this really upper class food. I mean, it was hilarious. You know, to think that John Kerry is a man of the people is ridiculous, and he isn't out there. You know, I mean, you could tell that somebody handed him, they put the clothes on, they dressed him like a Barbie doll. He was basically a Ken doll, and they dressed him up, put a shotgun in his hands, and he probably walked 40 yards, and they were taking this thing. And okay, that's fine. The next thing was, remember when Barack Obama, who hated Camp David because he thought it was like some old fogey hangout, and he would never go there unless he absolutely had to. And one of the few times he went there, remember the fake pictures of him skeet shooting? Those had to be Photoshopped. And, you know, it just, you know, they want us to think, oh, these guys, you know, they're into the Second Amendment, you know. They believe in hunting and shooting. They just don't believe in those evil black rifles and Saturday night specials. And, you know, it goes on and on. And now this clown Joe Manchin, who, you know, I don't know why the people of West Virginia didn't boot this guy, man. I mean, they had a good chance. This guy is an astute, anything Schumer says, Manchin will vote for. When you have a Democrat, you don't have an independent thinking person. You just have an extension of Schumer and Pelosi. And they will vote the way they're told to. You know, it's like democracy in the Middle East. You know, if you're a Shia in Iraq, you vote the party line. And that's what all the Shia do. That's why democracy is such a good deal for them. They're like, yeah, this is all right because we can control everybody and make them all vote one way. They can control the majority anyway. Well, the Democrats are the same way. They control. They completely control their members. They don't have renegade members. You know, they used to years ago, but they don't anymore. So, you know, Joe Manchin, Mr. Second Amendment, you know, and he's got deer rifles and he shoots deer and he's not going to give his guns to Beto. I guarantee Joe Manchin does not own a single gun that Beto wants to take away. Beto is not really looking for the hunting rifles and all that. They'll get those later. Beto mentioned AR-15, AK-47, and I bet that lion-ass Joe Manchin does not have either of those. He can't. He can't, or he wouldn't be a Democrat. And he doesn't have them hidden away. He's never been photographed with them, has come out with him, never fired him. So he's, you know, he's a liar. And here's the deal. Here's the real deal. They'll go back even to the 1960s if they have to And let's just say, for sake of argument, AR-15s and AK-47s and all those types of things are gone, and people are just owning bolt actions. They're going to go back and they're going to say, you know, these bolt actions are too dangerous. These are way too dangerous. John F. Kennedy was killed by a bolt action. Martin Luther King, Edgar Meivers was killed by bolt action. They'll go to every killing of a prominent person by a bolt action. And, you know, they'll find half a dozen of them. And they'll say, these are too dangerous. These are sniper weapons, you know. And then maybe the bolt actions go, maybe we're allowed to keep lever actions. Then it'll be, well, you know, back in the cowboy days, these lever actions were very dangerous. I mean, they're not going to stop. You're not going to satiate them. We just draw the line here and now with the AR-15s. So there's no such thing as a pro-gun Democrat. A pro-gun Democrat is an even bigger liar than the anti-gun Democrats. At least you know where they stand. Pro-gun Democrats are trying to weasel their way, get your vote, get your money, and then they're going to turn on you. That's what a pro-gun Democrat will do. Okay, another thing in the news. Colt ceases manufacture of AR-15s for the civilian market. So presumably they will still make M16s for the military market, but no more civilian AR-15s. And you know, this was met with a big yawn. 40 years ago, this would have been huge news because Colt was the only manufacturer of AR-15 rifles back then. You know, the bottom line is Colt, they tried to get into the retro market, what was it, 5-6 years ago with their M16A1 replica retro rifle. And the thing was like $3,000. I think it was like $3,000, and they didn't sell any of them. They just, you know, they had other companies are producing. Brownells produces an outstanding one, and it's, you know, under $1,000 on sale. I'd grab one if I were you. If you want one, grab it now. They're on sale. A bunch of their stuff's on sale. Very cool stuff, too. But Colt ceases manufacturing. They did this once before. It was after one of the incidents. The reason they're doing this is, just like Walmart's not making any money on ammo, just like Walmart didn't make any money on AR-15s, so they stopped selling those in 2015. They stopped selling ammo for most things this year. They're trying to get a little bit of mileage out of it, you know, doing it right after these last two incidences. But the fact of the matter is, with Walmart and Colt, they're both bailing on product lines that aren't making them any money. Colt used to be the gold standard for AR rifles. Now they're just Colt, and everybody. There are a lot of manufacturers that turn out a higher end rifle. There are a lot of manufacturers that turn out rifles that are perform just as well and are more economically priced. Just the way it goes. You know, Ruger makes a really nice AR-15. So there you go. So Colt is not making money. Colt, the most popular firearms in the American and international markets, the 1911, Colt gave that market away. Just gave it away. They wouldn't innovate. They kept their prices high. They absolutely, you know, just gave that away. And they tried to introduce, you know, the Colt Double Eagle. Remember that clunky, looks like something from, you know, if Planet of the Apes had handguns, which they don't, but if Planet of the Apes used handguns, they would have the clunky Colt Double Eagle, you know, horrible looking thing, performed terribly. The Colt All-American 2000, which was a disaster, a complete, utter disaster. The Colt 1991, which, you know, is, as a bare bones 1911, is not a bad gun. Once you replace the plastic trigger and plastic mainspring housing, yeah, those are nice touches. So they wrecked the 1911 market for themselves. They wrecked the single action market for themselves. You, Birdie, and everybody else produce Ruger, you know, I mean, it goes on. Produced single action. The largest growing shooting sport of the last 40 years, arguably cowboy action, and Colt has almost no representation in it. Yet, guns that they originally introduced and produced are the type used. And it's all these other manufacturers came out with less expensive, durable copies and clones of Colt firearms. And they own it, and Colt does not. That was a market that Colt owned because they had the product brand name recognition. But, you know, they threw it away. They just absolutely threw it away. And the last is the AR-15 market, the most popular gun in America. And Colt can't make any money on it, even though they originated it. I mean, for the civilian market anyway. Yeah, I know, Fairchild and Stoner and Sullivan and all that. But they sold all that to Colt. And Colt started making them like crazy. And, you know, sold them to the military as the M16. And sold semi-automatic versions. And they never really marketed the semi-automatic version. I mean, it was absolutely given to them on a silver platter, and they never did diddly squat with it. I have to tell you, I had, when I was in college, I bought a Colt SP1, and, you know, I was firing it this morning, the same gun, firing it this morning. It's still a great gun. Outstanding, high quality, very well made, really nice gun. Well, you know, when I first bought it, I can remember going to the range, and I've told this story before, and people would just shun and just like, oh, that's crap, that's a piece of garbage, you know, and, you know, it's on and on and on, and yet here it is all these decades later, and it's still shooting. It's a great gun. It's absolutely reliable. It's absolutely accurate. It had the same barrel that the M16 line used, the, you know, chrome line, microparticle inspected, you know, the whole thing. And it's a great rifle. And it suffered for years from this horrible reputation that grew out of the early part of the deployment of the Vietnam War. And everybody's heard that story, you know, they're jamming and cleaning rods and this, that, and the other thing. But Colt could have done what InRange TV did. Just hold some simple mud tests with the AR-15 versus the AK-47 or the AR-15 versus the M14, and they could have turned that public perception around. It would have cost them a little bit of marketing money, and they would have had to put some effort into it. They could have turned it around, and they could have been selling scads of them in the 80s, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. They would be the Mondo producer of the world for commercial AR-15 rifles if they'd just done some marketing on their own product. But they were too stupid to do that, so therefore they got burned, and that's just the way it goes. So Colt out of the market, and they did this once before. It was after one of the shootings. They did this, and then they creeped back into the market. But I think the market is so full of manufacturers now that, you know, for Colt to Colt is just not the name it was. People just don't demand Colt. Collectors think it's cool, and shooters think it's cool. I went from a point where decades ago, people would basically scoff at me on the range with the SP1, to where when I take my SP1 out, like this morning, people are going, wow, is that a Colt SP1? Those are great. It's taken all these years and with no help from Colt, but the reputation of the rifle has done a 180 degree. It's really amazing. But I said, if you really want a great AR-15, and they don't give me any money, there's no free stuff, there's nothing, go to Brownells. Brownells not only makes a great retro AR, they make the Proto AR, which I think I'm just absolutely over the moon with that. That is a great AR. But they make great Proto AR. Every model of military AR, of every M16 in semi-automatic form, they make, and I mean, they do a great job. I mean, if you want one, now is the time to get it. Now is absolutely the time to get it. Okay, let's go to the third portion of the podcast, which is questions and answers. So these are questions that I've gathered, either come to me over the net, or I get in conversation, or people ask me directly if I would address these on the podcast. So I've collected a few of them here, and we'll start to go through them. So The first one is, are AR-style pistols useful? And if so, what are they useful for? Okay, first of all, I don't like AR pistols. That's just me. I think, you know, for, I don't know. There's several different kinds. Let me kind of break down. The first are the rifle caliber ones that they don't have a buttstock. They have a barrel shorter than 16 inches, usually 7.5 inches. And, you know, they take standard magazines. And so I see very little use for those. I just don't see much use for them. They're not accurate. They're not easy to hold. They don't have a good sighting system that's good. I just don't see much with those. Then there are the pistol caliber versions of that, which are a bit more controllable and make a bit more sense, especially if you put the put a pistol brace, which is a short stock looking device, which is meant to kind of brace it against your arm, but you can put it in the pit of your shoulder like a regular stock, according to the ATF, and be okay. So you can use a pistol brace. Those are a bit more effective. They're a bit more accurate, even on the rifle caliber ones. One of the reasons I don't care for the rifle caliber ones is they the muzzle blast on those things is awful. And the controllability problems are just terrible. And they come with AKs, have them too. And so these things are around, and I don't like them. They've even made HK, you know, the off the HK weapons, they've made versions of that. I think even stupidly, DSA has made pistol versions of the FAL. I mean, it just, I don't know. I don't see much use for those, especially in a battle rifle cartridge like 7.62 by 51, you know, the short barrel. The only possible use I can see for one are in places where compactness is the most important aspect of a weapon, and you're willing to sacrifice performance and handling characteristics and everything for that. And executive protection, you know, Secret Service detail type of things. Executive VIP protection might be another one. Perhaps some police use, clandestine, you know, having clandestine teams to go maybe scout out especially dangerous fugitives or some sort of a, you know, terrorist, criminal enterprise, hybrid type deal, something like that. You would have to take a lot of convincing, though, to get me to use one in lieu of a regular shoulder-fired weapon. I just would be, because you give up a lot for that compactness and convenience. You know, it's better maybe to find economies somewhere else rather than sacrificing everything for the size. So I don't know what a civilian shooter would really benefit, what the benefits of that would really be. You know, I think somebody just introduced one, CMMG in 10 millimeter, you know, they could go back to the bear attacks, I guess. You know, you could. Another aspect of that, though, as I'm thinking about 10 millimeter, is you have to really look at, you have to look at recoil of these things. You know, 10 millimeter in a very, very light pistol type, AR type pistol, or even a shoulder braced AR pistol, just, you know, that might be a fool's economy. That might be a deal breaker, especially if you're talking 10 millimeter. 9 millimeter, probably not much of a problem. How does it recoil and handle, and what kind of power does it deliver on target compared to the, say, the regular 5.56 version that we're all used to? And I would say that, you know, you're probably much better off using an M4 style AR than you are trying to get down into one of these braced deals. That's just my hunch right there, that if you can possibly tolerate the additional size, you're going to be a lot better off. So that's my thoughts on AR pistols. Okay, next question is, What type of groups should a hunting rifle produce at 100 yards? What type of groups should a standard hunting rifle, I'm assuming that's going to be, you know, when I say hunting rifle, we're going to say deer rifle, and we're going to say that it's probably, you know, 24 caliber large, something 243 and larger. We're not really going to talk about varmint guns and things like that. Not that it matters, because the answer is the same. The answer is it doesn't matter what kind of groups it turns in. It really does not. What matters, and you know what, and I see guys who want their hunting rifles to shoot, like mine shoots under three, you know, at 300 yards, I shoot under a minute of angle. It's like, well, so what? Who cares? What you're really looking for is get a target that's the size of the vital zone of the animal you're hunting, and basically put it out at varying distances until a third of your shots don't hit that vital zone anymore. And that's basically your maximum range right there. Because if you go farther than that, you're probably going to hit 50% or out, or greater than 50%, in which case you've exceeded your maximum range. And I would say that, you know, you don't do that by shooting and shooting and shooting. You do that with essentially cold bore shots. When you can't hit that zone reliably, that's your maximum range, and that's all that matters. Your hunting rifle was never designed. I've got a Remington 700 that a family member gave me. This is a gun from back in the 60s, so it's stocked with the usual, you know, kind of cheapo factory stock, you know, lightweight sporter barrel. Still has sights on it, which you never see anymore. You know, it's still got a front and a rear sight, even though it's got a scope, you know. You know, so it's the usual factory cheapo, it's got the butt pad on it, you know, the cheapo butt pad, you know, the permanent butt pad, but that cheapo butt pad. The scope on it is a loopholed. It's like a 2-7 loopholed. I think it's like a duplex reticle. I mean, it's nothing anybody would be interested in today. As a matter of fact, it probably deserves to be in the loopholed museum. Maybe someday they'll want it for their museum. The only cool part, the coolest part about this gun is it looks like a hunting rifle, and it's got these cool, somehow they found these leather scope covers for it, you know, the objective and forward and rear lens. They have these very cool, so it looks very safari looking, you know, it looks more high speed than it actually is. But it's a Remington 700 ADL, you know, internal magazine, and on and on. You know, and I just, why would you shoot that gun for groups? I mean, who cares? It's how far can I hit the vital zone of the animal I'm hunting? And if I'm hunting rabbits, it's not going to be very far, probably. I don't know that thing over 100 yards, I could even hit a rabbit. I'm assuming probably 300 yards, you know, with a braced position, that you could hit, you know, that vital zone of a deer, you know, consistently. Beyond that, I think it's up to anyone's guess. And the rifle is in .308 Winchester, so it's a good caliber. But, yeah, I see, I have friends, and it's like, they're out there at the range, and they're just going through all kinds of ammo, you know, and worried about the groups and all this. And I'm like, what are you worried about? Can you hit the animal you're hunting? And, you know, then they, and of course, you know where this is going. They're out there, their rifle shoots well. Then when it heats up, it does start shooting very well. And then sometimes it'll just go completely off the rails. It goes completely south, you know, goes completely bad. And then you look and you go, yeah, my favorite thing is to do is, first thing I do is touch the scope, and if it jiggles, we know we got a problem. And, you know, you check the mounts, the screws, because all that is, you don't know who really mounted it. Sometimes these stores, you know, oh yeah, we'll mount your scope for you. Well, you know, I can only imagine that there's a broad, to be generous, there's a broad spectrum of talent that's doing that. And did they even Loctite anything in, or did they just put it on there and just kind of, they certainly don't, in my experience, they certainly don't torque wrench it. So, you know, they put it in there, kind of get it hand tight and send you on your merry little way. And then it winds up out at the range, and holy, holy cow, Batman, you know, 20 rounds later, not only is the barrel got pressure points on it from the cheapo factory stock, and so it's that's causing it to go a little wild, but now things are starting to loosen up and get jiggly. So, you know, I wouldn't worry about it. I do know a guy who basically he shot his 300 Magnum so much that he burned out the barrel, just fried the forcing cone, and he was also shooting kind of hotter loads in it, and, you know, getting that barrel replaced, and I think it was a Browning, you know, Browning A-Bolt, I'll say that's what it is. I'm not sure. It was a Browning. I'm not sure which model. And, you know, getting that replaced, you go through gunsmith after gunsmith after gunsmith, and Browning, their customer service said, send us the rifle, we'll give you a credit, and you can go buy a new rifle. You know, I mean, people aren't really revved about changing barrels anymore, because they're afraid receivers will crack, or you know, you just won't get that good a result. So you really have to think twice about kind of what you're doing. That's one of the reasons I really like Savage Rifles, man. I mean, it's a little bit of work, but you can get that barrel off. The user can change a barrel, and compared to having to dig up a gunsmith and beg some guy to do it and find a barrel maker who's got the right kind of barrel, and I mean, you know, all of that fun is avoided if you have a Savage rifle. But it's avoided, and you may never even have to ever change a rifle barrel if you just don't try to shoot. They're not bench rest guns. They're meant for carrying, and they're meant for engaging a game animal at reasonable distances. And some of this long-range hunting stuff, you know, again, I don't hunt, so this is just unvarnished, you know, spectator peanut gallery opinion, and treat it as such. But I don't know that you can even see game animals and make positive ID and all the other stuff that you need to do. It's almost like the military, you know, making positive ID on a target before you engage it to make sure that, oh, shoot, I can only shoot a buck, and I just shot a doe because it was standing next to this bush, and it looked like horns, and it wasn't horns. It was just branches on the bush, you know, 500, 600, 700 yards away, which is what some of these guys are talking about. You know, that becomes a thing where the most important thing is not the rifle. It's the glass that your spotting scope and then the rifle scope maybe. But I don't know. I would just say that, you know, if you can hit a target at 100 yards, if it shoots basically cold bore where you're aiming, and it's within an inch or two of that point of aim, then you're probably just fine, and you're going to be able to engage out to any reasonable distance that you see a game animal. But it's a fool's errand, and basically a wrong road to try to go and, you know, group size, bench rest, and all that, a hunting rifle. It's just not meant for that. Just not meant for it at all. Okay, next question is, what is the farthest pistol shot you've ever made? And I think that's pretty easy, and it's really not that exciting. So, well, here it is. To give you some quick background, in the late 1980s, I was stationed at a very dreary place called Fort Irwin, California. And I got there, I came there from Germany, and, you know, so I was used to metropolitan Germany, which was, you know, beautiful, lush, and had cities and all kinds of, you know, social activities and all kinds of exciting stuff going on, fast cars, autobahns, and everything. You come back to the States, and then you're out in the middle of the desert. And so, very quickly, though, I became a desert rat, and to this day, I still really like the desert. I just love it. I love the wide open spaces and some of the solitude out there, and the opportunity for shooting is outstanding. Well, we had a rifle and pistol club, and we had a rifle range went out 400 or 500 yards, not a KD range or anything like that. It was just had target stands, and they actually went up a hill, so, you know, it wasn't anything that you could really do competitions or anything, but it was fun to shoot there. And so on the pistol portion of that, we actually made some frames and hung up a few tank hatches and things that we had scrounged. Fort Irwin had been, they had a lot of old artillery targets, which were old armor vehicles like, you know, and you'll need Google to help you with this, but M42 Dusters, you know, the twin 40-millimeter anti-aircraft gun, a couple wrecks of those, M59 armored personnel carriers. There were even wrecked Sherman tanks out there, you know, M4 Shermans, and there was actually one wreck that they thought was an M3 Grant. There were some guys out there who were real tankologists, you know, they were armor officers, and they knew every nuance of historical tanks. So even though the M3 Grant and the M4 Sherman hulls were very similar. And if you ever saw an M3 Grant, they're really cool. They got that funny looking gun on the side. It's, if you ever saw Humphrey Bogart in Sahara, the movie Sahara with Humphrey Bogart, that's an M3 tank. They're very cool looking, you know. They're very odd looking to us nowadays, but they do have this kind of diesel punk cool look to them. But anyway, there was a wreck of even one of those out there. But we would find some hatches, and some of the things were too big, you know, because an armored door is pretty freaking heavy because it's armor. But we did find some tank hatches that were, you know, a couple, you know, 2.5 feet, you know, around, you know, diameter, you know, that type of thing. So they were large and they were heavy, but they weren't outrageous. And we welded these things up. And they were fun, and we got to the point where, you know, there wasn't much else to do out there. So loading up mid-range 44 Magnum loads, and even some 45s, we could sit there and ding those hatches that were hanging out at 100 yards. And we could do it, I used to be able to do it 4 out of 5 or 5 out of 6 times, you know. I usually would miss one, but you know, we'd usually catch it, you know, the vast majority of the time. And it was a lot of fun. We did a lot of hand loading, did a lot of shooting. It was great. And, you know, even tried it with 22s, you know, that was pretty much a pretty hard hill to climb, to hit it with a 22 handgun. But hitting it with a 44, you know, and these were mid-range loads, 240 grains. I forget the powder charge, but, you know, they're going out about 1,000 feet per second. So they weren't full magnums, but they were more than a 44 special. A very good load to shoot, and we were shooting them out of predominantly Smith & Wessons. And I remember my favorite was a Smith & Wesson 6, no, not a 6. It was a Model 29 Classic Hunter with the unfluted cylinder. And that was my favorite 44 for that kind of shooting. And it had the adjustable front sight, the long-range four-position front sight. I never really adjusted it much. It's a little complex, but, you know, it was a great sight and great visibility, and that really helped it. So it was a great gun to use, and, you know, it makes a Smith & Wesson believer out of you. Now, while that may sound impressive or unimpressive to you, it doesn't really matter. All it takes, though, to hit, and this was from the standing position, this wasn't from, you know, bench rest or anything. We got to the point where we could do this from the standing position, two-hand hold, kind of an isosceles stance, if you will. And all it takes is practice and figuring out where your gun shoots, what the holdover is. It's not as difficult as you think it would be. Any, you know, moderately skilled handgunner can do this. You know, you just need the range where you can do it. But any moderately skilled handgunner, you know, and it also goes to the environment that was there, which is, you know, you get out there in the evening, you know, the sun was still up, but, it, you know, sun was kind of getting lower in the sky. It was very relaxed. You could concentrate on shooting, and you know, it wasn't a high use range, so, you know, it was very relaxing. You could concentrate on it and do it, and that was part of it, was the environment. You could do that, and you could also set up intermediate targets. So, hey, if you can hit the 50-yard one, you can do a little bit more of a holdover, hit the 75, and then go to the 100. And that was a very enjoyable. It's very impressive when we brought people out there and kind of showed them. They're like, "Wow, you can actually do this." And it's like, you know, all it is practice. Like most of the shooting disciplines and everything else, practice makes perfect, and perfect practice makes, you know, whatever it is. So you get out there, practice, and it's fine. You really shows you how important trigger pull is. Sight alignment, and you know, getting over some habits if you flinch or if you tend to jerk the trigger, and so all of those are very, very important to practice. And the longer range you can practice, the more you will see your mistakes. A lot of mistakes with both rifle and pistol. A lot of mistakes surface, and you can really see the effect of them. At longer range. Closer range, you might get away with you know, something that's maybe an inch to the left or right, but when all of a sudden you're shooting at a long range and it's 4 feet to the left or right, hey, then you get it, and it gives you something you can work on. So that's my farthest pistol shot, and so that's what we would do. I did notice that in the Guerrilla Gunfighter book, the author, you know, goes, "Well, I can hit a man-sized silhouette at 100 yards. And it's like, well, so what with your Glock? Okay, that's very nice. I'm not poo-pooing it, but I'm saying that's not all that unusual. And it's really not all that great. I can take any handgunner, even pretty much a novice, and you could have them, if you work with them and they get confidence, they can make those kind of shots. Okay, our next question, and this is different from the stocked AR pistols, because that's really a rifle style action that's just been reduced down to legally make it a pistol. This is about stocked pistol carbines, you know, like the Broomhandle Mauser, the Artillery Luger, the certain models of the Browning High Power, and there's even a few other esoteric ones. The Finnish Lati has got, can have shoulder stock. Any of those ones, I think they kind of conked out right at the end of World War II. Star made some, I think up until the 70s, maybe even the early 80s, Star continued to make some for their 1911 style pistols. But the bottom line is, everyone I've tried has not been very good. Part of the problem is, and actually Forgotten Weapons kind of identified this, if you go on, look at for some of the Forgotten Weapons videos where he talks about the stocked Browning High Powers or Broomhandle Mausers and things. That joint at the back of the grip where the pistol grip and the stock mate is usually kind of loose. I assume that's by design, because every one I've seen fits essentially the same way. There's a little bit of play in there. But they're disappointing as carbines. The two best performers I've seen are a stocked Artillery Luger, which was able to hit a man's silhouette at 100 yards. And that's pretty good. And a Broomhandle Mauser, which, you know, is kind of a funny design anyway. And it really lends itself to having the stock, because it really kind of operates, I don't want to say rifle-like, but it's so unlike any other pistol that it's essentially a very, very good little carbine. And in fact, they made, with both the Luger and the Broomhandle, they made complete carbine versions of those. So those worked the best. The Browning High Power was kind of disappointing. It, you know, just the design of the pistol with the kind of the toggle link and the way it locks up and things. It's not really, no barrel bushing. It's not really conducive to the kind of accuracy you would expect from a carbine. And they all basically suffer a bit for being very awkward. I mean, the stocks really aren't proportioned right. As a matter of fact, they're kind of like these pistol braces now, you know. They're a little too short. They're not really comfortable. It's not really well thought out as a stock. I mean, it's usable, but it's really not well thought out. Just like these pistol braces that people are putting on the back of AR and AK pistols. So, yeah, I don't really, they're fun, they're great pieces of history. And they're really interesting and cool looking, but they do not give a tremendous boost to the performance of the gun that they are attached to. The base gun is still, its performance really does not increase all that much. But you do get some benefit of increased range and a little bit of stability, but it's really inferior to a rifle and certainly inferior to a submachine gun. So that's what I would that's how I view those. Buy them for the collector appeal, not really the utilitarian appeal. Okay, our last question is, which lever gun would you use for defense? And I'm assuming that that means personal defense. And I'm also going to assume that that means that as no semi-automatics are available for whatever reason, whether it's, you know, legislatively or whatever the reason, that there's no, all of a sudden I'm in a world where there's no semi-automatics and I need to select a lever gun for defense. So, you know, that's actually a very germane question because I've been in that world, actually. I grew up on a cattle ranch, and we did not have semi-automatic. We did not have ARs. They were available. The AR was available, but nobody I knew had one. Nobody even knew in the gun magazines we looked at. It wasn't even advertised or anything. I mean, they were available. Nobody really knew about them. Nobody would have purchased one because they would not have seen a sporting use for it, as most of the weapons that people had were for hunting. You know, that's what happened there. In rural America, there's a lot of hunting. People grow up hunting. And I can remember at that time, I thought the ultimate firearm, the one that I really wanted, would have been a 30-30 Savage combo gun. 30-30 on the top barrel as a single shot and a 30-30, and a 20-gauge, I'm sorry, a 20-gauge barrel underneath. I mean, that was the gun. That was the gun I was jonesing for. Because I could hunt all kinds of different things with it. And the operative word is hunt. That never came about, but we did have lever guns. And lever guns, pistol caliber lever guns, unless they were antiques that were around, they weren't the deal they are now. This was before they had the Winchester 94s coming out in 44 Magnum, and we never saw the Rossies in 38 Special, 357. All of those were off the table because they just weren't around. In those days, and this is going back, in those days you bought guns at like Western Auto. You bought them at Sears. You bought them at hardware stores and at places that did not have a tremendous selection that stocked models that they knew would sell. Nobody knew or thought that a 357 lever gun would sell when most people wanted a 30-30 because it was more powerful. And the only 30-30s available were Marlin and Winchester. And of those two, Winchester was by far and away more predominant. I can remember going into places that sold guns. And again, this is out in rural America. And I mean, you would see maybe two or three pistols in a case. And they'd have maybe half a dozen rifles and shotguns. You know, three of each. I mean, and that was the selection. These were not dedicated gun shops. These were stores that sold guns as a product line. And, you know, you kind of, depending on how desperate you were, you went in there and, you know, hey, there's three rifles here. There's three shotguns. You need a shotgun. Well, you get, choose one of the three. Same thing with handguns. As a matter of fact, I remember jonesing for a Ruger 41 Magnum. Would be nice to have now because a nice three-screw, you know, beautiful gun. The fact of the matter is, though, nobody had ever heard of 41 Magnum. That's probably why it was still sitting there because nobody knew really what it was. I mean, people had heard of 44 Magnum, hadn't really seen any, but had heard of them. And, of course, that's when the legends of the 357 Magnum were, you know, it could crack a car block, you know, from, you know, 50 yards away and all these other stuff. None of it was true, but we didn't know that because very few people had 357 Magnums, and most of those were police or sheriff's deputies. So, you know, it is what it was. So that's where most guns were bought. But I can tell you, growing up on a cattle ranch, there's all kinds of things happen. And one of the things that happened was, of course, one of my jobs, being a low man on the totem pole in the ranch world, being not exactly the top hand, my deal was to clean out irrigation ditches and make sure the ditches, the water flowed where the ditches were. And you had to go down there and you had to scoop out some muck every once in a while, or if a rock had gotten in there, you get that out, you know, or sometimes the wall of the ditch, by animals coming up to it, they'd kind of wear a path and some of the water would spill out. So, you know, you had to go and repair these things, and that was my job. Well, I was doing that one day when some local yokels came down the road, and the ranch I was on was large enough so that, you know, there was a county road kind of bisected it, so there wasn't anybody else around there. It was ranch land on both sides of the road, and these turds came down the road, and they pulled out a .22 and they started shooting at the cattle, just as a prank thing. You know, they were shooting at them, you know, try to hit them in the backside or something, make them run, and they thought that was like really funny. Well, I see this, and then these guys start coming down the road towards me. So they see me, and before I can even move, and these guys are driving like a 60s fast kind of car, like, you know, a Ford Fairlane that would have had, you know, a 350 or a 289 or something in it. So they come roaring by, and they point their fingers at me like pistols, and they start doing that. And they know I've seen them shoot at the cattle. So while they do that, I DD-mow back to the ranch house, and it's just like a TV Western, man, you know, go into the closet, and I pulled out a 30-30, which was my 30-30, you know, a post-64 regular 20-inch barrel 30-30, and a box of cartridges, and away I went. And I loaded that baby up, and I waited for them to come back, because I thought, if these dudes come back, they know I've seen them, they know me, they know my face now, and they know that I'm going to do it. And I'm like, they bring a .22, they're going to be answered by a 30-30, and that's what I had. So if I had to choose a lever gun for defense, I would choose the same one that I did all those years ago, and that would be a 30-30-94 and a box or two of cartridges, and I'd load that baby up, and if I had to expend a couple rounds, the minute I got a break, I would put another couple rounds in there from the box of shells in my pocket. There were the pistol carbine, 73s around, but they were the antique ones. The repos hadn't even really hit the market then. Frankly, those guns are just too heavy, and even though they got a much greater capacity, they shoot weak rounds. They're heavy, they're longer, they're awkward. They don't feel like a fighting kind of rifle. That 20-inch barrel, you know, there's a reason that a lot of military weapons are kind of centered on that 20-inch barrel. It has a very good feel, very good balance. It's portable enough, and it swings, and it's fast enough. But that's what I would choose, and I would not feel that I was at a horrible disadvantage unless people had AKs and ARs. But yeah, if some guy had a deal. The only other gun that would be suitable would be, and people would laugh, but a 10-22 is a pretty cool gun, you know. Got the magazines that pop in, you know. We had a 10-22, but we didn't have nearly, we only had the two magazines that came with it, and this was before the time of extended magazines and all the rest of this. But, you know, a 10-22 with a 20 or 30 shot mag would have been pretty much ideal, you know. If those guys have a 22, I have a 22, but I got a 30-round mag, and I've got something as reliable as a 10-22. You know, you're on pretty even footing. But a, you know, a 30-30, they get hit with a 22, it might take them out. They get hit with a 30-30, the chance of taking them out is much greater, but you don't have the amount of shots. So I would choose the 30-30. It's a great combination of power, accuracy, and a nice handling rifle. Another option if you can get it in a 20-inch barrel, is .38-55. You know, that's kind of an older black powder style cartridge. And, you know, that's a very cool gun also. 30-30 was, you know, back when it was introduced, it was looked upon as a pretty much a high-performance type of cartridge. Now we poo-poo it. We say everything else is better. But that doesn't mean that it still can't do what it did back then, and it can still do some good stuff now. So that's the lever gun I would choose for self-defense. And Winchester 30-30s are getting hard to find now, but I think you can still get Marlins. You know, I see them around occasionally. I think Henry now makes one, and I think they even have a loading gate, which I think is a pretty good deal. To me, the way that the modern Henry rifles load, but pulling the tube out, I've got a Browning 22 that's the same way. That's a deal breaker, man. I would not want to use that for defense. I would take the King's patent loading gate over that every time. It reminds me too much of a muzzle loader, that you're pulling this thing out and then putting the rounds in, even though it's not a muzzle loader, but it just kind of looks that way. I don't want to be trying to reload like that if I'm under threat. As a matter of fact, you know, knowing what I know now, I can put a couple of cartridges into a 30-30 without having to really look down and pay a lot of attention to it. I can feel that loading gate, slip them in there while I'm still scanning around looking for any trouble that's coming my way. So, you know, the 30-30, if you live in one of those areas where owning anything else is a serious problem, the 30-30 is still a darn nice gun to have. Well, that's it for another edition of Old School Guns. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. And again, please hit the like button. Please hit the follower button. Please hit anything. Feel free to leave us messages. We would be happy to answer any questions that you have. We're picking up some more views, and more people are downloading the podcast. So welcome to all the new listeners. I know that there's some as far away as Australia. So I think that's pretty cool. There's been a few in Canada, and you know, that's really kind of exciting to think that somebody that far away, even New Jersey, has got a couple of people that listen. So you can be as far away as Australia or as close as New Jersey or any points in between and still hear us. But welcome. We like to hear from you. And this is Old School Guns out.